I'm David Mazenbring, and this is the fourth in a five-session series called Investing in a Better World. This session is called Service Learning Trips versus, and I do mean versus, Transformational Travel. I mean, they can work together, but I'm going to try, just for the sake of making a point, to oppose them a little bit. And I also, in talking with Carlos before we started, thought I should say that after being very critical of a lot of sacred cows all week long, today and tomorrow I'll move more toward positive things we can do that are hopeful answers rather than hard to hear concerns. So my, I just want to note that, and I almost used it in the original draft of the marketing stuff up for the kiosk there, that service learning projects, or service project travel, either way you say it, is a growth industry among U.S. churches and educational institutions. It's growing, and we're going to see more of it. So worthy that we give some attention to how does it work well, and where does it struggle. In evidence of my belief, my faith in that statement, I'll cite that a New York Times op-ed piece that was published after I put up on the kiosk the description for this session. Monday of this week, David Brooks in the New York Times writes, and I'm grateful to someone who's not in the room right now that gave it to me, this op-ed piece called The Rugged Altruists. Many Americans, and he starts off, many Americans go to the developing world to serve others. A smaller percentage actually end up being useful. Those that do have often climbed a moral ladder. They start out with certain virtues, but then develop more tenacious ones. And he lists three, the first two of which I agree with. The first one they possess, and they start off with, he says, is courage. The willingness to go off to a strange place. And he cites a little narrative example of how uncertain it can be, that I can relate to, having traveled a lot. That you just throw yourself out there and sometimes you have no idea what to expect and whatever you're expecting doesn't eventuate. Second virtue that is that they the second virtue they develop, as opposed to start with, is deference. The willingness to listen and learn from the moral and intellectual storehouses of the people you're trying to help. And I'll read the example he offers because it's compelling, and many of you from your own experiences can relate. Rye Barcutt was a student at the University of North Carolina who spent a summer sharing a 10x10 shack in Kibera, the largest slum in Nairobi, Kenya. One night he awoke with diarrhea and stumbled to the public outhouse. He slid onto the cement floor and vomited as his bare body hit puddles of human waste. He left his soiled pants outside the hut, but when he went to find them later, they were gone. He was directed to another hut where a stick-thin girl with missing clumps of hair had had the pants scrubbed and folded in her lap. Barcutt said softly, "I'm grateful," and asked her why she had cleaned them. "Because I can," she replied. A week later, she died of AIDS, and her body was taken in a wheelbarrow to a communal grave. I'll remind you that that's his example of the second virtue that the rugged altruists develop, which is the deference, the willingness to listen and learn from the moral and intellectual storehouses of the people you're trying to help. The greatest, he says, and most essential virtue is thanklessness, the ability to keep serving even when there are no evident rewards, no fame, no admiration, no gratitude. And he lists an example of someone that he thinks should have been grateful and wasn't for the help that they got from the traveler. And this is the one I disagree with. I think that if you go with a service project mentality, then you do need to have that virtue of thanklessness, but I'm not sure that's the only way to go. And my thesis today is that reducing our blindness about how most people live is a great, if largely untried, way North Americans can help improve the world. I toned it down a little bit just to leave myself less vulnerable to the critical among you who might challenge me. But if I was a little bolder, I would actually say that I think the most important thing North Americans can do to help change the world is to travel to the global south, the poorest countries, with service project hands tied behind our backs, and go only for the purpose of learning how most people live. Now, you know, people can rightly criticize me and say, well, isn't that kind of a luxury for us just to go educate? People are dying for lack of water, etc. But I maintain that that a lot of what's best about our culture will respond if we get properly educated about how most people live. The problem is that we're trying to fix them before we really understand them and before we've learned to listen to a partnership with them. So that's my thesis. It's, in a nutshell, travel to transform the traveler. Think about it, most of these service projects, my son this summer went with a school group, 17 high school kids from Garfield High School went to share technology with a village. Last summer, a group from the same school, the same nonprofit, went and built a computer lab for this little school in a very poor village in Nicaragua. This summer, they went and taught software. But everyone agrees that's not really the most valuable part of the trip. So why do we have to make it the object? Why do we have to say we're going to help them? Why not? And does the objective to help actually get in the way sometimes of the learning? You have insights into that. And I thought it'd be good just to, at this point, work a bit with, oh, I have one more thing I forgot. And then I'm going to ask you for some of your own, to share some of your own best travel experiences. But first, I want to, in defense of my critique of Brooks, that we should have, we need this spirit of thanklessness, or in my critique of the idea of going for the purpose of helping them by giving them something from us. The book, I didn't bring a copy, but I'm sure there are still copies in the bookstore, Help. It's got the life vest on the cover. It's right up where the teaching staff book recommendations are. In that book, Help, there's a huge section where Kaiser talks about the Good Samaritan. And he sums up his opinions by saying, we need to remember which question the parable of the Good Samaritan addresses. Who is my neighbor? Not how do I love my neighbor? I hated that passage for the longest time because of the way in which the way in which it's commonly used. It's often used to teach us how to help our neighbor. But that is not what that text is actually about. I'm not going to take the time to defend my that argument right now, but you read it carefully. The question Jesus asks is, who is my neighbor? And that text is not about how you help the neighbor, it's who is the neighbor. And for that reason, it's a great manifesto for what I'm arguing for, which is travel to transform the traveler, when that traveler is a North American, richer than those being traveled among. All right, now, what to bring to mind, bring into the spirit of this room, some examples of your best travel experience among places and or people of difference. Okay, so you might have had a wonderful encounter with a stranger in the grocery store of your neighborhood, but think more exotically than that. And it may not have been halfway around the world, maybe it's in New Orleans, but travel among people of difference. What was your best experience, Bill?
Well, as I read your description there, it seems to me that study abroad fits that, depending partly on how different the place is that you go.
Right.
And I was over 50 before I got to study abroad in Chengdu, China, with the PLU program. And I was expecting things to be different there. I didn't have the, what do they call that experience? Well, anyhow, my eyes were more opened when I came home and could see with more open eyes how it is that we live.
Hmm. Yeah.
I wonder why.
Home looked different when you returned to it after an experience in China, where you went for the purpose of study. Is that a fair?
Study and teaching.
Studying and teaching, okay. All right. Others? Back here.
I went to Guatemala with a team from Common Hope, and it described our team as a visioning team. And we were exposed to, Wayne was a Guatemalan social worker, to a home, seeing how they teach people how to sew, helping with the house building. And I think it was for the purpose of gaining support from us, financial support, you know, as we...
Tell me who the group was again?
Common Hope.
Common Hope, okay. Okay. Yeah, more and more nonprofits that work in the Global South are learning the effectiveness of taking potential donors or supporters of their organization and showing them, giving them an experience like they've never had before in their life, and along the way showing them what good work they do, because it bonds the donor and the nonprofit. It's a very effective strategy for doing that. Jane.
I'd like to just share something from our experience with the Russian Parish Partnership that was at St. Mark's Cathedral, but was also at a number of other churches in the Seattle area. And there was a Presbyterian church who had a very strong partnership with a church in near St. Petersburg, Russia. And they always went on missions, whereas the people at St. Mark's, we thought of it more as like a pilgrimage. So there was quite a different emphasis. But one time they went and they helped to build a wall, a fence around the perimeter of the church property. And it was a new church that was being built after the fall of communism. And the metropolitan, the main, you know, prelate in St. Petersburg, he came up to the leader of the group and said, "Why are you doing this? We have Russians that can build fences. Why, you know, this is..." He almost felt, I think his feeling was that it was almost degrading that these Americans were coming over here and building a fence.
Hmm.
But and I can see his point. But at the same time, the people who went there said that the bonds that they built, working side by side with the Russians, in a way that because of language difficulties and everything else, you might have trouble doing just talking, but you know, working together, form very strong bonds.
Right. So there's a good example of where the service project hindered some group dynamic, but you still worked alongside people in a way on that project in a way that fostered transformational experience. Bonds were built, and it wasn't just that the bond was established. I'll bet you there was some cross-fertilization of ideas and experience and love and connection. And so the question I want to ask there is, how much of the time is what's best, and I would love a few more experiences here, what's best about a service project, I mean, from my son's experience, the experience of teaching software to other kids was the official reason they were going. But in the course of it, it gave them contact with the other kids. Contrast that with the type of service project, and we all have seen examples of this too, where a group of Americans go down there and really don't have much contact with the local community because we're building the school. Or what other? Yes, Matt.
So I travel quite a bit for my work to lots of places internationally, but I've also taken some trips with my mother, who would normally be at Holden Village this week with me, but isn't. She, for the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years has been traveling to Africa, outside of Arusha, and we've got some family friends there. And originally, I think it started out as a learning trip that then became getting to know the community and partnering with a Lutheran organization, a Lutheran church there, and some people that we knew there. It's become sending a carton of clothing and supplies every 2 years. And I think the most impactful thing is that when some of those people that have been collecting and sorting clothing and goods have actually been able to go on these trips with her. I've been on a couple of them. And I would have to say that water pumps impact the lives of the women in the village, not having to walk miles for water. Mm. It changes the family dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But we also took a lot of people from the Minneapolis area that are very comfortable in their homes and put them in homes of very average Africans. And that's where we stay. And being part of that, realizing that oftentimes the clothing that we had on our bodies and what we were carrying in our backpacks was worth more than, you know, in American dollars or global dollars, what the family might own.
Mm.
We were fortunate to meet up with local people in the villages, the Maasai. I'm hoping that my children will be able to go because they were a little bit young the next trip. It really, to me, very much is about, we were certainly bringing things, but we really had some rich experiences, and it was really based on being able to interact with the people and understand what they needed, not what we wanted to give them.
That last phrase is really key. I'm going to quote it. Understand what they needed, not what we wanted to give them. And when you do a repeat with the same community, one of the good things that can happen is that the group that goes learns more about what is appropriate to bring and what isn't appropriate to bring. And it also illustrates the argument I made earlier, which is that if we understand who these people are and how they live, we will respond generously out of our abundance to answer their need, but that's different from starting out to do that.
Along the same lines, I worked for the Christian Peacemaker teams for a number of years, and my first introduction to the organization was going to Palestine and Israel for 2 weeks for a learning delegation with them, and going around meeting primarily the Palestinians, but also Israelis engaged in peace and justice issues and asking what was needed. Not a single person ever said, send us money, dig us a well, even in the drought-stricken South, send us textbooks, come here, teach English. There was never any of that. And we were talking with leaders of nonprofit organizations, but also shopkeepers and taxi drivers and shepherds and farmers. And they told us the same two things over and over and over again. Go back to your country and tell my story. Go back to your country and change your government, especially if you're a citizen of the United States. And digging a well would have been so much easier.
Yeah. Right.
They have such a deep understanding of what is really necessary to change things in that part of the world.
It's a wonderful illustration. And that's less about what I meant by how most people live, but it is about what most people in that situation are most concerned about, you know, in their difference. When I say how most people live, I'm really thinking of material circumstances, how far they walk for water, how much they own, what their income level is. But of course, in the case of the Palestinians, given that the United States is the number one ally of Israel, and that Israel has embarked on this long campaign of ethnic cleansing that we sponsor militarily. Really important to get that message back. One more.
I'll share about my experience in Nigeria. my wife and I and 6-week-old son went there right after I finished graduate school in the 60s, and I taught school there for about 5.5 years. Then 5 years ago, I hadn't been back there since, but I went back for the first time after nearly 40 years with an NGO in Minnesota called Global Health Ministries, which works with health projects with Lutheran churches around the globe. And what the church wanted from us, we were looking to see where we might partner with the health program of the church in Nigeria. They wanted to reestablish the glories of the past, the hospitals and the curative programs of the dispensaries and so forth. And we talked with them, and after we went back each year for 3 years to really get a feel for things, and we finally saw that community-based primary health care, where you start at the bottom of the village and development and water and supporting of the village, was probably where we were interested in supporting them. And it took a while for them to understand, but we sent some of the leaders to see other programs that had been effective. We sent about 10 to India to a community-based program that had been operating for 40 years there. And we've now negotiated, and I think they really believe that this is the right path to go. So our NGO is going to work with the church on the community-based health programs, including water and things. So.
That's a great illustration for several reasons. First of all, I want to highlight the way it illustrates the manner in which we have made a lot of places in the Global South addicted to our earlier ideas for what they needed. Hospitals, hospital institutions. I've talked to any number of doctors who've come from England or the United States and worked in Africa, is where I have more experience, and who just bemoan the fact that instead of keeping people well with water, we're waiting until they're in crisis and then provide a hospital to. And that's a very expensive way to go. But we've built those institutions in a non-locally sustainable manner. So when they get the chance to talk to us again, what they want is to restore the glory days of those institutions that we're kind of getting tired of paying for. So that's one point. Second point, you used what's called South-South exchange to raise the consciousness of the people who we had led down the road of thinking that the institution, the big hospital institution, was the way to go. Much better than trying to convince them yourself. Much better to send them from Africa to India and back, or from one part of Africa to another part of Africa. Not everybody that, you know, I mean, I was legitimately critiqued earlier in the week for suggesting that you know, we just go to the world, we'll find all the answers. I mean, there's a lot of our relations with the world that are corrupted by the history of how we with power have worked with people without power. Some of you saw the Biko film yesterday. There were black informers working for the white security police, you know, against the interests of their own people. That's an extreme form of corrupting the people we want to be building community with. We have built corrupted forms of community, and cannot assume that everybody outside of our borders is, you know, is going to lead us in a good direction. We have to discriminate who, and that comes up. But if we look, we'll find great people. All right, let's move on. I want to quickly name and list here some of the factors that hinder. Some of the dynamics that hinder the objective of travel to transform the traveler.
Our own expectations.
Say more what you mean by that.
We may want to help in one way, and we have that stuck in our minds. And that may not be what's needed.
All right, others? Just shout them out here.
Narrow-minded arrogance.
You first.
What was the other word?
Arrogance.
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 Prejudice.
Maybe arrogance is always narrow-minded, I don't know.
Prejudice. Racism.
The need for instant gratification.
Fear.
How about language?
Language, yeah.
Fear.
Cultural appreciation.
What do you mean by that?
I noticed on one of the trips that I was on that for one particular woman in our group, it was very difficult for her to accept that the culture was so different, the role of women was very different, and that was just, it was a cultural issue that you have to deal with. You can't impose your own view of the world to help. I'm not articulating that very
so
well.
So accepting cultural differences.
Accepting cultural differences.
Like dressing different as a woman? In another culture?
Mm-hmm.
No. Like when you're in a Muslim country, if you're a woman from the West, you can't dress
right
the way you would here without offending your culture.
The group that goes, if you go in a group, the group that goes can be a hindrance, right? I mean, you cited being in a group with someone who really struggled with some of the cultural. That can be a drag. You can have members of your group who, the group dynamic can be dysfunctional, and members of the group can interfere with the progress you want to make, the connection, or the group can be, my first experience internationally, outside of North America, was going as an exchange student to West Africa. And I went in a group of a dozen American students. I was 20 years old, out of the Midwest. And it was scary to go to West Africa for me, culturally scary. And I retreated to the security of the group of American students. I mean, not 100%. But when I came home, I had to admit that I was not one of the one or two in our group who had really moved out into the African university and taken an African roommate and hung out with the African students. I hung out with the American students and blew it in many ways. I teach my kids, no mistake is a failure if you learn something from it. And I learned from it. And I was determined when I went back to Africa then a couple of years later to go alone. And that was a huge dynamic that helped.
I think things even like weather bother people. I mean, that tolerance of not being physically comfortable.
Weather can definitely have an effect. Thank you. Jane.
I think I'll say this is having had experiences being leaders of different groups. You have people in all different, as you were saying, different places when you go. And I think one of the things that a leader sometimes tries to do is to make, take the responsibility that those people have a good, your people that are with you are going to have a good experience. And you have to walk a balance between, making sure that everything's going right, but also have people take their own responsibility for their learning and their good time.
Yeah, the group dynamics, the group that travels. Dick, two more quickly, Dick.
It really pays to be adaptable and flexible, because when you get to the place where you're destined to go and you find that conditions are such that it's impossible to accomplish what you set out to do, well, instead of just throwing up your hands and coming home, adapt to conditions and...
So a factor that hinders travel to transform the traveler is inflexibility.
Yeah.
Good. One more back here.
I was thinking about self-interest in the sense that
You know, when you tell your friends you're going on this mission trip, you have to be doing something. To just learn something doesn't seem to have the, you know, whatever effect.
I know. I'm going to tell you about a trip that we took last year. And one of the biggest barriers we faced were that people really couldn't believe we weren't going to do some service. You know, they could not accept. And where does that come from? How many were present Monday night when I talked about Steve Biko's thoughts? It's, you know, I name it as the white superiority complex. Our superiority complex hinders our ability to be transformed as a traveler. And one of the ways it shows up is this notion that we have to help others. But I argue that if you go with a service project, you cannot serve without some posture of superiority. All right? I mean, what does it mean to serve someone? It means you have a largesse that you want to share or give that they don't. And it's just not the best posture in which to learn.
Patronizing.
It's patronizing. It's all kinds of things. The best posture in which to learn is, I want to hear from you. I need your help. And that the white superiority complex, endemic in our culture, and not just whites, but American superiority complex, is a big hindrance. Were you trying?
I was going to say another dynamic I think that hinders is if you have not prepared the group. We have a sister parish in El Salvador, and we did a lot of studying and informing our group before we about the history of that country, the war, the people.
Lack of orientation.
The politics.
Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. That's a good list. I'm going to keep it. This is the first time
I'm
I've done it.
I'm going to say one more thing, and that is that I think I mentioned it at breakfast the other day, but if you don't have clear ground rules about giving money, because people will hit you up for money, and then
I'm going to cover that one. I'm going to cover that one on what makes for a good trip. Some of these are, you know, two sides of the same coin. But you're stealing my thunder there. I won't let you
know. I'm sorry.
And oh, you're going to make me more credible when I try to make the case. All right, so let's talk about dynamics that help. And I've already referenced the fact that where I work, St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle, there's a new transformational travel ministry group that's gotten started, and it grew out of a trip to Nicaragua. Now, why Nicaragua? Because St. Mark's has a long history of Nicaraguan solidarity work. And there was a group that arose in the 80s and thrived in the 90s and declined in the first decade of this millennium. And by the time I got there, was pretty much gone and formally retired. But there's a lot of history there. So in an effort to, if you said we were going to travel somewhere, Nicaragua is the second poorest country materially in the Western Hemisphere, and St. Mark's had a lot of history there, so we decided to go back to Nicaragua. Now, I was under great pressure to go back and pick up the pieces with the village where we had once had a relationship, and where we had done a lot of health and education assistance to that village, and it had gotten all messed up. We thought we were helping the whole village by working through a certain family, and then we found out that that family and its relations had been empowered in a not very healthy way within the village because of all the material aid coming in from our church. And their relatives and their friends and their allies were getting all the goods and creating resentment. Peter Singer, in his book, The Life You Can Save, has some of his strongest words of criticism for child sponsorship projects and what they do to divide communities in which one child gets sponsored and another doesn't. And trust me, you never sponsor every child in the village, so that's always going to be the case. But it's also, of course, as I was saying earlier, a fundraiser's dream. It's the easiest thing to raise the most money for. I'm getting off the subject. So we took a group of 12 people in the end, and I think 8 to 16 is about the best size that I've concluded to go with. And I want to share with you some of the dynamics that really made this what I call a God-blessed trip. And before I forget to mention it, there are some, there's an article written by the youngest member of our group, 13 years old, which is called Nicaragua from the Eyes of a Teenager. That's pretty astonishing for the transformation it reflects. And then when I came back, I preached a sermon called, that's not the right sermon. I wondered why I had two copies in the notebook there. It's, so I better grab the original back here. It's called Curing, A Cure for Blindness, ? And back on that chair are some copies. If we run out, we can run upstairs quick and make more. About the trip on the way back from it. So what do we feel are some of the factors that made it work? One was we started off with a Bible study. And we took an hour to do it. I'm not going to do the whole Bible study now, but I'm going to give you a taste. Because it's a Bible study on strangership. Now that is not a common word in our lexicon, but you can easily get your mind around it if you consider how familiar is the word friendship. And strangership is just a different dynamic. If you think about it, in friendship, we protect, we have a lot to protect. I actually might share, but guardedly, carefully, I will share some of my deepest thoughts with a friend, only if I think that the friend can hear that. I mean, there are some things that I share with some friends that I wouldn't share with other friends because the other friends aren't really going to be open to that, right? We have something to protect in a friendship, and it bounds us. It limits how deep we're willing to go, how quickly. Unlike my experience hitchhiking when I was younger or other experiences of encountering the stranger where you can go very deep very quickly. When you hitchhike, you're with a total stranger for a very limited period of time, and whether you upset them with some of your ideas or not doesn't really matter, unless you know you're afraid they're going to kick you out of the car or something. But as soon as I started going to the divinity school, I discovered that hitchhiking would expose me to often how people wanted to have their annual religious conversation. You know, they found out I was in divinity school, and then among these two strangers, we could go really deep into theological issues very quickly, much quicker than I would go with friends. So we began first morning. You fly, get up, meet early on Saturday morning after Thanksgiving at Seattle Airport. And in a couple of different routes, land, gather meat in Managua that night, go to a retreat center, an ecumenical retreat center, which was, by our terms, pretty uncomfortable. And first thing the next morning, we did a Bible study on strangership. And it's the story of the road to Emmaus. And I just want to take you through quickly a bit of it here. On the road to Emmaus, the story starts with verse 13. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but they go down the road, the two disciples, and while they're talking, discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them. Their eyes were closed from recognizing. And he asked what they're talking about, and they stood still looking sad, and then one of them says, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem?" Okay, so that's the title for this Bible study, Strangership. Jesus is identified as a stranger. "Are you the only stranger who doesn't know the things that have been going on here?" And Jesus says, "What things?" And so they begin to open his eyes. Now, throughout this period here, from verse 13 through... Where's my master? It's not 28, I'm sorry. I'm only seeing part of it here. No, it is. Jesus is the guest. right? Through verse 20. Whoa, wait a minute, what's wrong here?
Missing 9 verses.
Missing 9 verses, missing thank
19,
you.
28.
All right, there you go. So through verse 24, they're teaching Jesus. They're the host. Jesus joins them as a guest, right? And the two disciples are the host. And then it shifts suddenly in verse 25, and Jesus becomes the host. Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all the prophets." Doesn't sound like the talk of a guest to a host. Sounds like Jesus has now taken charge of the conversation. He's become the host. And then in verse 25, he says that to them, and opens up the scriptures to them, interprets the things about himself and all the scriptures. In verse 28, it shifts again, and he goes back to being their guest. As they came near the village to which they were going, Jesus walked on ahead as if he were going on, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it's almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. He goes back to being a guest. He starts off as their guest. He becomes their host teacher for a little while. Then he becomes their guest again, and in particular, for homestay purposes, which you highlighted about as a powerful dynamic for the exchange between the churches, your congregation, and the African experience. And I'm going to highlight it also as a powerful dynamic, homestays. Then he gets to the table, and this guest suddenly takes the bread, blesses it, breaks it, and gave it to them, like a host. So he's back to his host role. Verse 33 to 35 is something else. And afterwards, in verse 36, Jesus is the host again until verse 41, when he goes back to being the guest. While in their joy, they were disbelieving and still wondering, Jesus said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. That's guest behavior, right? And then he goes back to being the host again. So what's the point here, in short? That strangership implies a fluid movement between being the host and being the guest. What's the posture of a service project? What's the underlying presumption? How do you do a service to others?
You're always the host.
I mean, not ideally, not in every situation, but basically you're operating from the host dynamic. And I think in this, so we started that first morning with a Bible study on strangership that introduced three words: strangership, host, guest. And it really helped us all through our 11 or 12 days. It gave us a way of naming the experiences we were having. When were we a host? When were we being a guest? Who were the strangers we met? I highly recommend starting with something. I mean, this isn't the only Bible study you could do that would be helpful to a trip, but it was huge for us as we moved through that week. I also want to draw your attention to verse 31, which I think we need to back up for. In verse 31, then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. In the Bible study, we talked about how hard is it to recognize the gifts of the strangers that we're going to be among. So a fourth word we introduced was gift. Stranger, guest, host. Gifts. What are the gifts of the strangers? And verse 33 to 35 is something else. I'll just draw your attention to the fact that Jesus is off the scene at that point. So it's not how Jesus is teaching us how to be strangers, but it is the result of strangership. The disciples are offering enthusiastic witness to or of the stranger that they had encountered. And that's a piece of really effective strangership. If you go travel, if you engage in authentic strangership, you are going to be transformed in a way that you will want to give witness to when you come back. So one important dynamic for us was starting with a Bible study that introduced a framework we could use all week long to help analyze our own experience and remind ourselves of our goals, which were to learn. Secondly, we saved, and this was really, I won't take any credit for how this happened, but there was just this feeling that from experience that if we waited till we got home to debrief the trip, we would lose a lot. And there was a tension between you only got 12 days, you got millions of things you want to learn, could do, but should we actually save a big chunk of time at the end to debrief and reflect on our experience before we went home? And we arrived, at the most comfortable place we stayed at the very end of the trip. And we had a little kind of Nicaraguan resort. I hate to use the word resort because it conjures up images that are not accurate for the material circumstances we were in here. But it was more comfortable, nice food. We arrived at dusk on a Sunday evening and left at 4 a.m. Tuesday morning. So we had the whole of Monday. And I contracted. I had been kind of going along with the group and following, trying not to dominate all the decisions. But at the end I said, I'm taking charge here of a reflection piece. And some people in the group, because we were in this lovely lake, volcanic lake, and there were beautiful hiking and birds and everything. So we said from noon to 3, or maybe it was noon to 4, will be fun time. But all morning and late afternoon, we're gonna work. We made 3 lists. We started by, I said, who are the strangers we've met? We came up with 90 people. We didn't have their names, all of them, but the guy who sold us that Washington State apple off of his cart on the street in Hinatega, we didn't know his name. And not everybody had everyone in the group encountered, but we were able to bring into the room the spirits of 90 strangers we had met. And it took 45 minutes to get that list out and record it. Then I said, what are the gifts we think those strangers might offer us? We came up with 95 themes of things. Now, some of them are on the romantic side and maybe wouldn't actually pan out and prove true, but some of them were already so apparent. We had already received those gifts. Some of them were gifts we thought maybe they could offer us. Some of them were gifts we had received. Who were the strangers we met? What were the gifts we think they might offer us? And thirdly, how can we bring the gifts of these strangers we've met closer to our community? How can we share those gifts when we get back home? So our service, it turned out that our trip was in training for a service project that began as we headed home. How can we share what transformation we've tasted with the people we're going back home to? And we decided there were 3 ways. We can bring selected Nicaraguans who we think will make a big impact on our community and also help stir up more interest in future trips. We can organize more trips, and we can interpret our experience through like this article in the church newsletter, where we did a photo exhibit and created it, shared it with the St. Mark's community, and then have sent it to another church as well since then. The final reflection time, the early Bible study, and in between a daily period, and this was hard to do because sometimes we were late. We got late on leaving for the first thing we were going to do in the morning because we started the morning or sometimes ended the day with a circle of reflection in which we sat in a circle. And we didn't actually say you first, you second, you third. But we said everyone is going to speak once about their own state of being. And there's going to be no commentary back and forth. But everyone's going to have a chance to say how they're feeling. Just check in. How are you doing? And that was the gift of Witness for Peace, with whom we had some relationship the first few days of our trip. that their experience had taught them how valuable that was. I wouldn't have anticipated it. It was huge, because it turns out that Mary, there was no Mary in our group, so I'm making the name up here. Mary had really not slept last night at all. And she was able to tell us that. And we were able, as a result of knowing that, to cut her a lot of emotional slack during the day, because she was running on no sleep. Because, you know, she was sharing a bed with somebody that she wasn't married to. And that was not a usual experience for her, or because the dogs were barking, or because she was afraid there were cockroaches crawling up and down the walls of the room, or whatever had kept her from sleeping. Or other people were really excited. It was a mix. And one day Mary was tired, and the next day Mary was elated because she had slept well, and she could be the positive force, and John was now, you know, running low on sleep. So a start-off Bible study that gave us some language to use to analyze or to categorize our experience during the week, a daily check-in, and save a prime chunk of time at the end to get down on paper some debriefed experience that we could hang on to. And we made commitments over dinner together that night, and some good meals together go a long way toward building the group experience. And we were able, we didn't do it all the time. You know, we did, I'm going to say homestays in a minute, talk about them. But when we were not in homestay, we tried to sit at one big table, you know, in a restaurant. Nicaragua, the dollar goes a long way. So this did not drive up the cost of the experience. And order a few drinks for those who want them and just relax in each other's company. And sometimes, depending on the organizations we were meeting, we would invite some of the people we had passed, crossed paths with during the day, to come and join our dinner table that evening. Those were hugely effective at helping us share what we had learned. And different people, you know, you go and listen. We did a lot of what the 13-year-old complained about as classes. You know, we had a 13-year-old, we had a pair of 23-year-old women who had just graduated from college and weren't sure what to do next. So they're at a very dynamic moment in their life. And then we had some working-age adults, and we had some retirees. I think the age diversity made a big difference. Any demographic diversity, I think, can make a difference. If you go to Africa and you go in a group that is mixed black and African, European-American and African-American, you're going to have a different experience than if you all go as European-Americans or as African-Americans. Any form of diversity helps with that flexibility factor that you were talking about, Dick. It's a challenge, but it just helps. The more alike the group is, the less tolerant it is of difference, I think. The more different it is, the more it rolls with that. Group diversity, daily reflection, final reflection, homestays. We did urban and rural homestays, divided up usually in pairs. That made the reflections really important, you know, because we found out that some people had air conditioning and some people, you know, didn't even have ventilation in a hot, stuffy, tropical place. Homestays are a good way to get to know a fellow traveler. They're obviously the best way to get to know the local people. And urban and rural group meals. I'm going to tell one story, and then I'll cite a couple of resources, and then we're out of time. So the Lutheran World Federation has a wonderful project, except that they haven't introduced it in the United States, and so it isn't yet working. It's a rural, they came up with this beautiful, beautifully designed program to empower, for women's empowerment, by promoting rural tourism in Nicaragua. They went into the northern mountains, which are 10 degrees cooler and a lot of percentage of humidity less, so much more comfortable. and went to rural cooperatives and organized women. About, to get this website down so that you can take advantage of what I'm about to teach you. Mata Galpa Tours.com. Went into some rural cooperatives, women who had been, who are very much under the thumb of their men, were rounded up and taken off to a weekend of training on how to host tourists. And then they got the funding to add a little casita in this remote rural spot. The casita, which just means small house in Spanish, consisted of a room or sometimes a little building right next to the house that had three or four things that they decided were barriers for American travelers, Western, European and American travelers. A cement floor instead of a dirt floor. Right? I mean, if you think about it, that's one of the things that will keep a lot of us from going. Secondly, a bed with a mosquito net. My bed was virtually raw wood, and next time I'm taking a backpacker air mattress. A flush toilet instead of a pit latrine. You can go. I mean, most people, if they have any good sanitation, it's going to be a pit latrine, but that can be a barrier for some North Americans. If it isn't for you, you can find plenty of ways to avoid the flush toilets. But these casitas that were built by the Lutheran World Federation have a flush toilet, and usually right next to the toilet, a little spigot coming out of the wall with cold water and a drain there so that you could take a shower. And I stumbled upon these, and we scheduled, went to it. I stumbled upon it through Matagalpa Tours, which is three young Nicaraguans that want to change the world through sociocultural tourism and have formed this tour company that I highly recommend for learning Spanish, doing homestays, visiting fair trade projects, learning about coffee, or going out to the rural areas. You know, I'm going to run out of time on the story. So we went out to stay in this co-op, break into homes, go into these casitas, have an initial meal with our host family, but then the women were cooking together in that room. And then the room was a living room. It was smaller than this little section here, but I could see in the far, the kitchen, where the women who had been trained were preparing our food. And after a morning of listening to elder men of the village tell us about the history of the revolution and the history of this co-op and the land reform and how they got it, and I thought, you know, we really need to hear from those women. So I called them out to thank them in my broken Spanish for, and I tried to get them to say, we'd like to hear from you too. And they're, you know, shy and smiling, and some of you who have traveled know how hard it is to get people to open up and tell their stories. And I thought I had totally failed because I couldn't get them to tell us anything, and we ended up just thanking them, and they rushed back to the kitchen. But about 2 hours later, one young woman in the group who had the best English came and sought me out and sat herself right down beside me and said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" And I said, "I think we're blind and we need your help to see." And I said a little bit more than that, but I did say that. I started with that. And by the end of the conversation, she said, "Maybe I can help." And she came back about 2 hours later and said, "The women are willing to talk with you." And it was one of the most precious moments on the whole trip. The women came in, we sat in the room, you know, we interrupted our plans and what we were going to do, and we made time right then. It was totally unscheduled. We sat in the room, and the women came in, and each one told their story. And it was the richest education of the whole trip. Stuff that we would have never thought to ask about, we started hearing through a translator. And then we, in turn, told a shorter version of our stories and the disparities among these common children of God just rose, became so obvious that the next steps were fueled. The last thing I want to mention, because I promised it earlier, was that the no gifting policy. You started to raise it. This was something we took from Witness for Peace. Absolutely no exchange of money from one to the other. Witness for Peace won't even pay the homestays. They did our urban homestays, and they will not pay the urban families that host you. We each took a bag of food to our hosts, rice and beans and something like that, but no money. Why? Because they said if money is coming from the privilege of hosting these Americans, then the voice will be compromised. If you want to hear what they think about Americans and their hopes for, I mean, Nicaragua has one of the most shameful histories of American intervention. And we knew nothing about it till we got there and went for the purpose of learning about it. I've gone 51 minutes and I'm not supposed to go more than 50. So we better finish, except to point out a couple of resources that I will write down here, a couple of websites where you can get other information about travel. And maybe I'll list the email for the group at St. Mark's. It's just nika@stmarks.org. If any of you are within striking distance and want to go on one of the future trips being planned, I hope another one will go the weekend of Thanksgiving, starting like Saturday for 10 or 12 days, and then maybe spring break.
Write that up there,
Nika. Nika at St. Mark. I will. I'll do that. There are a couple of those articles there. You've been very patient with a long lecture. Thank you very much. We could use another board member or two from PIBO if anybody's interested in that kind of thing. I won't. But we have hired a part-time staffer now who's making a world of a difference to some organizational stuff. And last year, we raised from Washington State $180,000 in investment in OICO credit. So we're getting a lot of momentum.
I talked to people, and you mentioned Kiva. Oh, yeah, I've heard of Kiva. But OICO credit, because there's this, as you say, if you have a picture.
You want the story.
That works better. The OICO credit is more of the Jewish tzedakah, is what they call it. You don't know who you're giving
yes.
to, and they don't know who they're receiving
from.
That's
right.
From.
Yeah. It is. Churches tend to be its strongest supporter. People who are, you know, who have a moral calling to something other than self-interested behavior. Not that we always live.